The men that you are seeing here designed the wings and the fuel tanks, as well as the instrument panel for the Spirit of St. Louis. He was an employee of Ryan Aircraft Company. And he was one who looked into many ways of making it so that planes would be able to fly long distances. So this man was very important in helping Charles Lindbergh to be able to cross the Atlantic. But the next slide may help us to figure out who this man is. If you notice on the New York Post's caption, they have spelled the words backwards. And so if you read the headline, it says, Hail, Wrong Way Corrigan. What happened was that Mr. Corrigan put together a plane where he combined a couple of engines and basically had a piecemeal type of airplane so the United States government would allow him to fly within the continental U.S., but when he said he wanted to go to Europe with it, they said, no way. So he filed a flight plan to go from San Francisco to New York. And after arriving in New York, he filed a flight plan to go back to San Francisco. However, he said that when he got up in the air, he got disoriented in the extreme fog, and his compass was stuck. And he didn't figure out that his compass was stuck until he was well over halfway across the Atlantic. And so he landed outside of Dublin, Ireland. So he was the second successful flight across. And although you might not imagine it, he lived out a normal life and did not die until 1995. And his whole life he maintained that his compass was stuck. Well, we consider this morning Jonah. And Jonah knew what direction the compass was pointing, and he clearly went the opposite direction. What I would like for us to do, though, is to fit this within the chronology of the book, so we are showing a basic overall picture of the chronology. Abraham was born in the year 2166 B.C. David became king over Judea in 1011 B.C., so that was about 1,000 years later. And only another into the next century, in the year 931, Jeroboam I caused the nation of Israel to split into two kingdoms. The north was called Israel, or Samaria, and the south was called Judah. And so when we are in the book of Jonah and it talks about Israel, it doesn't mean the whole country. It means the north part. It means the part that was also known as Samaria. If they were referring to the southern part, they would use the term Judah. Well, then in the year 759 BC, that is when the events of Jonah took place. And in the year 400, approximately, it's when the last book of the Old Testament was written. So as we look at the Old Testament, we have 1,400 years between the birth of Abraham until the events of the book of Jonah. And we only have about 350 years of events in the Old Testament after the book of Jonah. In other words, this is very late, and there has been much that has happened. The order of books in the Old Testament is not chronological, but the book of Jonah is very late in terms of the events. Now, the author of the book of Jonah was Jonah, and he came from a town called Gath-Hepher. The arrow on this points to where Gath-Hepher is. It's only 3 miles away from Nazareth, where Jesus spent much of his time. Now, Jonah was a prophet, and he made a prophecy. He is mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25. And that passage says that he, talking about the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, by the name of Jeroboam II. He restored the territory of Israel from the entrance of Hamath to the Sea of Arabah, also known as the Dead Sea. According to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he had spoken through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher. I have put an oval here. The lower portion of that is the area that is normally controlled by the northern kingdom. That's the area that Israel normally occupied. But Jonah made a prophecy, and we don't know the year that he made his prophecy, but it was sometime between the point in 793 BC when Jeroboam II became king and the date when the war occurred in 773 BC. That part of the oval that is above the dotted line is the part of land that Jeroboam conquered. Now, does it look very likely? Would you normally expect for a country to double its area during the reign of one king? Now, that's not one of those things that you're particularly expecting, especially since the kingdom that's up in the north there is Assyria, the strongest world power of its day. But Jonah made a prophecy. Jonah prophesied that Jeroboam was indeed going to conquer major portions of land. Now, one of the things that's always puzzling about Jonah, you know, normally preachers like to have big crowds and like to have people respond positively to what they have to say. But Jonah wasn't exactly your normal preacher. Jonah didn't want the people in Nineveh to respond to what it was that he had to say. And the question becomes, why? What was Jonah's motivation? Why is it that Jonah is reluctant? His reluctance is explained in chapter 4, verse 2. He went west along the dotted lines to the area of Tarshish, which is in southern Spain, when he was supposed to have gone northeast to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. But if we read Jonah chapter 4, verse 2, Jonah has a complaint. Now remember, when Jonah was spit up by the fish onto the shore, he was very thankful that God had spared his life. At that point, he really liked for God to be gracious. But on the other hand, in Jonah chapter 4, verse 2, we find why it is that Jonah didn't want to make proclamation to the city of Nineveh. We'll start at verse 10 of chapter 3. God saw the works of the Ninevites. We will get more into what it is that he saw them do, that they turned away from their evil ways. We'll get to that in a future message. And God relented from the disaster that he said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. Please note that the disaster is in time. Is this talking about heaven and hell? No. This is talking about a nation as to whether it would be destroyed or whether the nation would continue to exist. This deliverance, as God saw how the people responded to Jonah's message, he did not destroy the city. Verse 1 of chapter 4, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to the Lord and said, "Ah, Lord, was this not what I said while I was still in my country, before I went down to Joppa and caught the boat to go to Tarshish?" Therefore, I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Jonah is one who knows that if God gives a warning, it's because God doesn't want to carry out the discipline. Now, if you walk up to a rattlesnake, Don't depend on this. But if you come up on a rattlesnake and it is shaking its tail, what's the idea? It's saying, back up, get away from me, don't threaten me. I'd rather not bite you. Like I say, don't depend on it. When the rattlesnake is giving a warning, it's saying, I'd rather for you to back up. When God, through the prophet, gave a warning to Nineveh, it was because God didn't want to destroy the city in 40 days. And I think that Jonah was saying, you know, if I don't go there, they're going to continue in their evil ways and God will have to destroy them. He said, I don't like God being gracious to them. It's all right for him to spare my life. I like him being gracious, and I'll praise God for delivering me. But I don't want to say anything about these Assyrians that would allow them to be delivered. Now the question becomes, as we look at the book of Jonah, what impression do we get? What a foolish prophet, right? All the way through, that's the impression we come away with. And that is the impression that the author wanted to give us. And guess who the author was? Jonah. Next slide. Did Jonah ever figure out his foolishness? Yes, he did. And it was when he figured out his foolishness that he was able to write in order to show the northern kingdom that it really is a good thing that they have a gracious God. We'll find out in future messages why it is so good for the northern kingdom that God didn't destroy Assyria at this time. Jonah figured, oh, it would be a wonderful thing for God to destroy Assyria. But he's going to discover that it really is a good thing that God did not need to do so. We'll hold on to that surprise for another time. Next slide, please. In verses 1 through 3, we see Jonah disobeying God's command to prophesy against Assyria. In verse 1, which this slide is looking at, Gath-Hepher is Jonah's home, and it's possibly where the word of the Lord came to Jonah. Now, off in the distance, if you look closely, that's the Mediterranean Sea. Gath-Hepher is up high, and it's a very interesting thing that it says that Jonah went down to Joppa. As you can see, Gath-Hepher is up high. And in this book, whenever Jonah goes down, something bad is happening. And Jonah goes down a lot in this book. You'll notice that if you're, when you read this, that it talks very often about Jonah going down. God has commanded him to arise to go to Nineveh. He's supposed to get up, but what does he do? He goes down. Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for it their wickedness has come up before me. But verse 3. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, and he went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Gath-Hepher, that is where the picture is very possibly where Jonah was at the time that God has given him the command. And what Jonah wants to do is escape from the Lord, and so he leaves. He goes down to Joppa, pays the fare, and goes down into the boat. Now let's find out a little bit about Nineveh. Verse 2a says that Nineveh is the city that he is supposed to make proclamation against. People often have a little difficulty with this because they say, well, Nineveh isn't a country. Nineveh is a city. Well, yes, that's true. It's the capital. Have you ever wondered when you watch Gunsmoke on TV that Marshall Dillon is the marshal of Dodge City? Have you ever wondered about that? A marshal covers a large territory. That's where the jail was. That's where the courthouse was. But he was the marshal of Dodge City, not saying that was his jurisdiction. That was his headquarters. We could say that on December 7th, 1941, Tokyo bombed Pearl Harbor. But we'd have to say, Tokyo is where the order went out, but it was the nation of Japan that carried out the order that came from the government. In this book, there's a focus on the city that is the capital, but it is the capital of a large empire, the Assyrian Empire. And here on this picture, off in the distance, you can see the walls of Nineveh. Saddam Hussein liked to see himself as Nebuchadnezzar. And so he was restoring all sorts of places in order to claim that he was going to be the great military victor who would arise out of this same territory. And if we go to the next slide, you'll see one of the rebuilt gates, the Moshki Gate at Nineveh. Well, then in verse 2b, Nineveh's wickedness came before the Lord. Within the argument of this book, the wickedness that they had was that they planned to make a strike against Israel. They were planning to conquer the nation of Israel. And their military prowess was greatly to be feared. They were a military power. They conquered the ancient world. And God tells Jonah that because of their wickedness, their evil power that was arising against and going beyond what God wanted the nation to do, discipline needed to be brought upon that nation. So then in verse 3, next slide, Jonah fled to Tarshish, but he had to make a stop in Joppa. That was the main seaport of that day for the nation, and it was down in Judah. So he had to travel a bit of a distance in order to get there. So that port is still an important port within Israel, although there are other ports. And we notice that he's gone down to Joppa, and he found this ship that was going as far away as the Phoenicians traded. And the Phoenicians went throughout the Mediterranean Sea area trading, and they made a fortune by their trading. And so here we have a picture of a Phoenician cargo ship that came off a sarcophagus. And we have a reconstructed ship on the next slide that has been sailed. It's called the Phoenicia. And we get several interesting clues about the boat that Jonah got into. It has more than one deck. We can see that from verses 3 and 5. Look at verse 3, where it says, he went down into the boat. So it doesn't just have one deck. He's able to go down into it. And then verse 5 says that he had gone down into the lowest parts of the ship. So he's way down low inside it. That tells us that there's more than one deck. It also has sails. And for that, we need a little bit of help because the translation in verse 6, where it says the captain, Literally, the Hebrew says, the chief rope puller. When you have sails, people need to pull ropes in order to elevate the sails. So this here where it has a sail on it, that would have been a sailing ship. And so the chief rope puller is the main person that Jonah was dealing with. There's another word that is used for captain in the book that would be a reference to the captain. But this man is actually an assistant captain. And then furthermore, we find out that this boat had oars. Look at verse 13 of chapter 1. Although there's this great tempest and it's increasing, verse 13 says, nevertheless, the men rowed hard to return to land. So we find that there's more than one deck, there are sails, and there are oars. The Phoenicians used boats like this in order to go throughout the Mediterranean as they traded, and so going clear to Spain is not unreasonable. That was something that they did at that day and time. As we look at verses 4 through 7a, we find that the Lord sent a great storm, and the fearful sailors urge everyone to pray to their gods. And I would translate it lowercase g and with an s. It is the word Elohim. And Elohim is a plural form. But when it speaks of the one true God of Israel, Elohim is referring to one true God that exists in Trinity. When the Old Testament uses it to refer to pagan gods, the same form is used, and then it should be understood as God's plural. Let's look at verses 4 through 7a. But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up. Literally, it says, the ship thought to break up. It's as if the boat were thinking. Then the mariners... And it's an interesting word that's used here for mariners, the salts. I mean, they were used to going out on the ocean, out on the Mediterranean Sea. They're seafaring. They're called salts. They were afraid. And every man cried out to his God and threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone down into the lowest parts of the ship, had lain down and was fast asleep. Can you imagine that? So the chief rope puller came to him and said to him, what do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your gods. Perhaps your gods will consider us that we may not perish. And they said to one another, come, let us cast lots that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us. So the first thing that we see is that God is the one who has sent this storm. God is the one who has arranged this in order to cause the prophet ultimately to come around to his will and to go to Nineveh. The sailors are fearful and they start praying to all their gods and they start dumping the cargo. Greg, you're going to find this interesting when we look at the cargo. Next slide. What we have here are amphorae, and it means two-handled vessel, amphi meaning both. So these types of terracotta jars were used for storing grain. They were also used for storing liquids like olive oil or wine or other things that they might transport. And you notice that they are set down into slats between the various boards. They're pointed. They're about 18 inches tall. There's a little bit of straw down there that they use as padding to make it so that they wouldn't be smashing against each other. And what they would do, as is depicted by all of these little diamonds, is they would stick them all down into these little holes and then into the spaces in between them, they would put more of these amphorae, and then they would put another layer, and they would keep filling up. Does this look like a very stable load? what's going to happen when this boat starts rocking? Well, there were a lot of ships that were sunk because these amphorae started dropping over to the side, and you know, they had all sorts of problems with them in order to maintain the stability of a boat. You can see why they would be going down there and hoisting these things out into the ocean. They're saying, we don't want all this liquid to be floating back and forth in the boat. It would add to the instability of this boat. So then, next slide, we have them casting lots. And so basically they would have stones, and whoever gets the wrong color stone, okay, what's your problem? And so they've approached Jonah and they've said, hey, how is it that you're sleeping through all this? I mean, we're fearful. We're tossing out all the cargo. Here you are asleep. And they are busy praying to every god they can think of and every god that they can't think of, and saying to everybody else, do you have another god we could pray to? I mean, come on, we've got to find someone who's going to solve our problem. And then, okay, well, let's cast lots. And it was God who caused the lot to fall on Jonah. And so it wasn't because they had any ability to discern that it was the true God. But do notice in verse 6 that they had said, arise, call on your gods. Perhaps your gods will consider us so we may not perish. So they don't get any answers. Jonah at this point is not forthcoming. It's like, well, I know I'm the one that's the culprit, but he doesn't seem to be giving them any answers. So they cast lots because he hasn't answered them yet. End of verse 7. They cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. So now it's interrogation time. It's not only this guy's been sleeping, how can someone sleep through this? But Jonah is the reason for all this calamity that has come upon us. So then they say, please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? I mean, speak up. What is your occupation? Are you some sinister person that the gods need to deal with? I mean, what do you do? Are you a murderer or a revolutionary? Or, you know, what are you? And where do you come from? What is your country? I mean, you certainly have gotten the gods angry, so fess up here. And of what people are you? Well, in verse 9, next slide, Jonah says, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord. Yeah, I'm really obedient. I obey the Lord. I fear the Lord. The God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. I fear the God who made all of creation. And he's in charge of the water. He's in charge of the dry land. You know, he's number one. And that's the one that I worship. And I obey him. And they're thinking, well, it doesn't look like you obey him very well. Seems like he's a little angry. Just slightly. So then, in verses 10 through 12, the sailors were shocked at Jonah trying to flee such a god. And they asked how to calm the sea, and he said, throw him overboard. Verse 10, then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, why have you done this? For the men knew that he had fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us? For the sea was growing more tempestuous. And he said to them, pick me up and throw me into the sea, and the sea will become calm for you. For I know that this tempest is because of me. They were saying, here, okay, what's going on? And so then their response that we have in the following passage was that they try to row to get to the land, Verse 13, but they could not, for the sea continued to grow more tempestuous against them. Their efforts were futile. Therefore, they cried out to the Lord. They are not here calling out to God's plural. They are calling out to Jonah's God because they've figured out that he really is in charge. Please do not let us perish for this man's life. They're saying, you know, this guy isn't very trustworthy. And if he's given us the wrong solution, if we are ending up killing your prophet and you're going to be angry at us, please know that we're trying to do what's right here. Don't hold us accountable. We're just taking this man's word. Do not charge us with innocent blood because you have done as it pleased you. They're looking and they're saying, you have done exactly what you've wanted to do, so please, just let us know how we can obey you here at this point. So, next slide. Yes, actually here, what happens is, they're saying, Jonah, you can't escape from God, but how can we escape? I mean, here we have God who's the creator of all, and Jonah's trying to escape from him? What a futile idea. Next slide. So they picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. And the men feared the Lord exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to the Lord and took vows. The sea became calm. God has made it clear to the sailors that he is in charge. And Jonah is starting to get returned to walking with the Lord. Jonah is definitely in rebellion here. And the Lord is able to deal with rebellious believers. Next slide. Remember our friend, Wrong Way Corrigan? Well, in the case of Wrong Way Jonah, God is able to direct his path even though Jonah is heading in exactly the opposite direction. God is able to work through circumstances to cause his word to be elevated despite the fact that we are sheep who like to go astray. Let's pray.